Hello, everyone. This is Mark from the Mark and Carrie podcast. Just a quick note, if you're subscribing to us through Trending Globally, go to Stitcher, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, and just look for Mark and Carrie, because we now have our own feed. Again, Mark and Carrie, do subscribe. See you there and then.
Welcome back. We're back for the fall after a short reprieve. It's hard to know how to start this, given all the constant updates that I've been getting through all the various news channels for, what's it called again? Brexit? I can't remember.
Yeah, no, it's funny that. So when we did our little summer special, of course, what did we talk about? Well, a couple of things we talked about was, of course, Trump and the trade war continues, Brexit continues, and it looked like there was going to be an end game. Not necessarily the trade war, we'll get onto that, but October 31st.
Yeah,
right.
Halloween.
So, as you know, we've scheduled a talk for October 31st here at Brown.
And the timing
for me
was perfect
to talk about Brexit, right? And then what happened?
Boris Johnson.
They went and changed the game.
Yes.
All right, so what's the quick recap on it? Let's do this by word association. You
Please.
Give me a Brexit word or person or whatever, and I'll try and string it together.
Okay, hard stop.
Hard stop. Backstop.
Oh, sorry, backstop. Yeah. Or hard...
Hard Brexit and a backstop.
Yes.
Right, exactly. So basically, we're heading towards a hard Brexit because there was no way that the Europeans were going to agree to change the backstop. Right.
Okay.
Which basically means there shouldn't be a border in Ireland between two parts of Ireland. Unfortunately, one of them's British. And one of them wants to be in the EU and the other one doesn't. And nobody knows quite how to solve that because there is no solution to that. Next.
Boris Johnson.
Right, Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson basically comes in and hires a guy called Dominic Cummings, who's the guy who ran the Brexit campaign and ran rings around everybody else. And he basically said, and this is a direct quote to a bunch of Tory MPs, which encouraged 20 of them to actually then desert and leave the party and stop hard Brexit. We'll go into that in a minute. You Tory MPs need to get this through your beep, beep, beep heads that we're beep, beep, beeping, leaving the EU on October the 31st and beep, beep, that's it.
Interesting. And also, he was played by Benedict Cumberbatch in the HBO movie on Brexit.
Just in case anybody wants to do it. Right. So what's actually happened to this point is the only way you could stop Boris just going tunneling towards a hard Brexit, because that's what he wanted to do, was if people in his party actually stood up and said, I don't care about the job. Yeah. I don't care about the next election. I'm against this because I think it's wrong. And I was utterly shocked that there were 20 people in the Conservative Party that had that degree of public-spirited, public-mindedness, and yet they did. I mean, admittedly, a few of them were old grandees like Ken Clark, but some of them were young up-and-comers who now have to find an entirely new career path. So they've managed to stop that, but this is where it gets even more fun. So Jeremy Corbyn has always said that he wants an election.
Yeah.
And as we've always said, Jeremy kind of really doesn't want an election. He just wants the Tory party to explode over Brexit. So they made elections a condition of not doing the Brexit deal. So the Tories left the Tory party and then that basically stopped Johnson doing what he wanted to do. Johnson said, let's have elections. And then Labour said no. So now we're in this wonderful limbo again where basically Labour is kind of saying, oh, go on, just die, just explode, please. And there's a limit to how far they can do this. So it looks like they're going to have elections, but we don't know when.
Is that the snap election?
I think that's the snap election.
So the snap election, it just means fast?
Snap means like, snap means Avengers Endgame.
Okay, got it.
It means that everybody dies in Parliament. No, it doesn't mean that, but you know, it means quick, yes.
So the hope, so Johnson is hoping for a snap election and that the quote unquote people will decide if there's a new government and whether to, like, that's the machinations I do.
Well, so basically the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which is a relatively new thing, means that he has to get 2/3 of the people in Parliament to vote to hold an election. Unless there's a no confidence vote in the government, which doesn't require a 2/3 majority, just a simple majority. So if Johnson wants an election at this point in time, he might have to call a no confidence vote in himself. I'm not making that up. That's actually true.
In hopes that he gets a no confidence vote.
Yeah, so
correct?
He can have an election because he thinks he's got a better chance of winning it, because he then joins up with Farage from the Brexit party. And then the two of them go, believe in Britain. And then everybody votes for them and we have a hard Brexit.
Because he has a majority then. Right now he doesn't have the majority. Okay.
Not even the majority in the parliament, majority in the country. Because Farage's party on its own, the Brexit party, is taking significant numbers of votes away from Johnson.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
So here's one last question. Could Labour get a new leader? I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is like as exciting as a pair of socks. Like, could they, or is it, though, that's like too hard to move those pieces around on the chessboard?
It's hard to move those pieces right now, and he is in charge and his people run it, run the shop. A week ago or so, Tony Blair came out of his crypt and said, hey, this is an elephant trap, because no good metaphor goes unmangled, by which he meant that if you go for elections now, you're not popular like you were a couple of years ago, you'll lose, right?
Okay.
But Corbyn's making the other bet, which is people really are sick of Brexit and really don't want to do this. And it's just this Tory echo chamber that says, yeah, Brexit, 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 and the media says Brexit, 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 and most people don't. Mm-hmm. So he wants the election on his terms when he's ready, as a kind of no. So in a sense, the election does become a referendum, but... You know, that's also difficult for the Labour Party because they've got some seats where they voted to get out. So what do you do with that?
I mean, the political class has also said we don't want Brexit, essentially, right?
Right. And that was the problem all along, because ultimately what was Brexit? Brexit was, if you will, a giant go get lost to the entire political class of Britain, who dragged them through Iraq, through the financial crisis, and through multiple years of austerity, none of which hit London and the metropolitan elites and everything that was farmed out to the north.
Is Johnson still able to shut down Parliament for 5 weeks, or that's still looming out there too?
You know, at this point in time, I have no idea.
Okay. I mean, it really is like a minute by minute sort
It's insane. It's like, and the thing is, the Brits don't have a written constitution. So this is all basically done through interpretation and norms. So,
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a thing called the Queen, or royal assent, which is what you get to make a bill law. But there's also a thing called Queen's consent.
Uh-huh.
And you can invoke Queen's consent to stop a law. I mean, really, this is just...
Wow.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Royalty sort of
this is a really good... Great advert for, like, getting rid of royalty. Anyway, we've been on this forever. So have the Brits.
But it's also a great advertisement for authoritarianism.
It's true.
So, I'll talk about that in just a second, but... Something happening right now, and we don't generally do real-time activities, is the hurricane, which John mentioned, one of our engineers, that it's pounding the Carolina coast right now. And as a president, wanted us to believe that it was also going to pound Alabama as well, and he used his Sharpie.
So I saw that on the newsfeed, but I didn't... So basically, when I see things like that on newsfeeds, I don't click on them, because to me, this is just distraction, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, big hurricane, it's destroyed Bermuda, this wonderful paradise... And it may go slamming into Florida. Lots of things could be damaged. People died. And then Trump comes up with a Sharpie and draws on it and says, no, it's actually going to hit Alabama. And the entire gaggling class goes, Trump, marker, Sharpie, and kind of forgets what's going on. So I didn't look at it. What actually happened, Carrie?
Well, he had the maps that shows the trajectory. And I did the same thing because, I mean, he also earlier, a few weeks ago, said he wanted to buy Greenland. And I thought that was actually an SNL joke. But so I understand this feeling. But he had the trajectory of the hurricane and he had tweeted a few days prior to that map that it was going to hit Alabama. And then it did change, the trajectory changed. But in the map that he held up in the Oval Office, he didn't want to be seen as being wrong. So he widened the curve of the projected landfall using his Sharpie. Now, the back and forth in the White House and is that they didn't want to deny, they didn't say anything. They said that someone had altered it, but they didn't know who. And to your point, like the
Twitter.
Yes, what went crazy and was like, but there's a Sharpie on the Oval Office desk and took the picture and magnified it and all of that sort of stuff. So it's hard to know.
Meanwhile, in other news, the Endangered Species Act got gutted.
Right.
You can dump as much methane as you want, which is 100 times more potent than CO2 in the atmosphere. Yeah. And what was the deregulatory outrage? That's it. Let's bring back a light bulbs we don't need.
Yes.
Because you can do all that when people are worried about Sharpies.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder, the line between to laugh or cry or just try to move on is so fine these days.
Just stop watching.
Yeah.
Watch what's done, not what's performed.
Yeah.
That's probably the way to do it.
One of the stories that I was following this summer, and this was, we had students traveling around the world and our students were flying through Hong Kong. So that became that became something that I paid a lot of attention about because the students, the Hong Konger students had shut down the airport for a couple days. And of course, that really shut down Hong Kong as well. It's been interesting to see this unfold as a middle class protest movement really driven by students. And today it was the embattled head of, I don't even know what her title is, Carrie Lam, finally said that she would retract the bill that started everything. I've been terrified for those students all summer that China is going to crack down on them in a violent way. And you just wonder what happens to a middle class protest that's led by students. Do they just go back to school? Do they get tired? Like, what exactly happens to this movement? I mean, in some ways they've had success, but how long is it?
It's more than students. I mean, sometimes they've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people join in.
Yeah,
so what's
right.
behind it? I mean, it's not just, I mean, they've been part of China for 25 years and people have been disappearing extrajudicially. So you might even argue that having an extradition bill puts it on the books at least. It's about more than that, isn't it?
I mean, I think in some ways it's about what so many countries are, I mean, what affects the U.S., the income divide, that in Hong Kong it's like $5 billion to rent a 1 square foot apartment, job opportunities. But I mean, the specific instigator was that Hong Kong was going to extradite anyone back to mainland China. And it's just the tension between the two countries, one system, two countries, whatever it is.
Right. But that's the weird thing about it. I mean, you know, the Brits negotiated that and have no way to, you know, to hold it up now, 20 odd years later. But I mean, it was one country, two systems, right? Yeah. Remember, it wasn't two countries, two systems.
Right.
And what they're basically going for is two countries, two systems. And all the way through the revolutionary period, through Mao, etc., the Chinese always maintained that, no, this is an integral part of us. Mm-hmm. It's on a 99-year lease. It's coming back home. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the Brits got to negotiate the one country, two systems, was quite remarkable. But you would expect after 25 years that would begin to fray. You know, what's the end game for a set of protests whereby you're a peninsula attached to China? You can't do a Singapore and just detach yourself.
Yes. I mean, I've been thinking the same. Like, what is their end goal? If short term they didn't want the bill, they've gotten that pulled. So what happens next? I mean,
if it's redressing economic inequality in China, you know, there's 800 million people that, you know, could have the same issues.
Yeah, and. I guess my hesitation and only thing that I get sort of caught up on is just hoping that there isn't anything beyond the violence that already happened, but widespread violence. So I was traveling at the end of the summer and did a bike ride through from Berlin to Dresden, which is former East Germany. You know this quite well.
I know this area well.
So first of all, I thought, wow, it looks a lot like Wisconsin, Minnesota. So you could see why Germans in the early 1900s felt very comfortable. But man, there was an election. And so there were campaign posters everywhere. Well, they were not subtle. They were really... I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say they're pretty racist.
Who's the Social Democrats?
The AfD.
The Alternative for Deutschland.
There was one poster that had a picture of a pig on it. And then I just did the translation, like Google translation, but essentially it said not fit for our kitchen. And you just think, wow, not at all subtle in terms of being anti-Muslim. But I was also struck by two things. The age of the people in this part of the country. I mean, this is my, you know, 5-day tour, so it's not very deep. And also that how rural it was, too. And thinking about the appeal and really mapping that onto the U.S., I guess, since I know that so much better, of thinking rural America, rural Germany, the age, etc., and how vulnerable that population can be to those types of messages.
And how disconnected they are from the people who run the country and have the money. I mean, this is the same story we keep coming back to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, that these two regional elections in the eastern part of Germany very much confirmed that the AfD is not a flash in the pan. Again, we've expected that. Structural populism's here to stay in a sense, right? And, you know, why is it they capture those areas? Well, you might say, well, it's migrants, but they're the areas that don't have any.
Right.
And the areas, it's like London, the areas with all the migrants that don't want Brexit.
Right.
So, you know, what's going on with that? And a short version of the story, again, is a very similar one you can tell elsewhere. You've got very old people in areas that have been in economic decline for a very long time. all the young people have left.
Yep.
And to the extent that, you know, they have any contact with the government, it's usually in some form of, you're all welfare scroungers, here's another round of austerity, more cookies for us, nothing for you. And the next thing is, there's a migrants crisis, the government has money to open schools, offer language classes, talk about integrating them in the labour market, and then you're looking at the fact that your kids had to leave home 10 years ago, and now they're going to bring all these migrants to live near your house. Now, that's not actually what's happening in any way at all.
Yes.
But that's the way it gets reported. That's how it gets translated. Yep. That's the way that it gets spoken about.
Yes.
And those things become real.
Yeah. And to your point, too, it gets on TV and that becomes very powerful. And the images that
we see.
I mean, it is interesting thinking about all the ties to what's happening in the U.S., of course, in the U.K. and like pretty much every country around the world, too.
But one of the things that those elections also showed was that, you know, the centrist parties aren't quite dead yet.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was any place that they were likely to crumble is the Social Democrats in the East. And they still, they lost votes, but they held on. And Merkel's side of the fence also lost votes, but also held on. So it wasn't a complete, you know, wipeout of those parties or a complete victory for the AfD. But, you know, it's kind of what we're going to have to expect now, that these parties are part of the furniture. They've changed the game, and we need to get used to that.
Right, because they did better than expected, right? They didn't win, but they did better than expected.
And the Greens are still doing better than expected, too. There's a story on the left as well. Yeah. But as usual, we ignore that story because they're all fixated on the right because they're nasty.
Yes, yeah. On the other side of the ocean, back to the U.S., we're in Democratic presidential debate time. There's another debate next week. Harder to get into that debate.
So there's only 300 this
time? Yes, but in one night of 300.
No, excellent.
So a night of 300 stars. And so I guess we'll have to talk about this next time to see who broke through and who didn't. But of course,
you study American politics. I don't. I just kind of like, you know, live it. But do people really break through on debates? I mean, is this really basically sort of the political equivalent of Dancing with the Stars or some crap like this?
No, as you were saying that, I was rolling my eyes because you're exactly right. The breakthrough is that the media says that there's a breakthrough.
Right.
And so, I mean, it really is the media has deemed Mark Blythe broke through. Therefore, he did.
And here's the thing. You know, how many people watch these things?
Oh, I think it's a ton, /0. I mean, maybe it breaks.
What's the average figure for cable news for like the big networks on like their big shows?
5 million maybe?
Yeah, I think
even.
It's even less than that. I think it's just a couple of million, right? So you've got this enormous country, right? And, you know, 100 million people that could vote, et cetera, more than that, in fact. And you've got 2 million people watching this event if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And then this is deciding everything. And it's just like one of the downsides, again, of having to have continual media.
Yeah. I mean, the horse race is so real. You feel bad for the candidates who actually have something to say. I don't know. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, I think, is a great example of that. She was down. She was up. Now she's up right now. But I mean, she's going to be down at least 3 more times until she's up again.
Someone that we were talking about the last time we spoke was that great empty suit called Joe Biden.
Oh, yes.
Right. So has he actually done anything to fill in that suit in the past couple of months?
No, he just mangled some more stuff. He told a story about a soldier that ended up being a composite of a bunch of different stories, really questioning his memory. I think it's been more fumbling around.
Bumble.
Excellent. Yeah. So we'll see if he fumbles or maybe he'll have his breakthrough moment.
He might have his breakthrough. You know?
I mean, his whole thing about that I'm the one who can win, I still actually find that to be fairly persuasive because I do wonder in the current political atmosphere that we're in, whether or not Elizabeth Warren could actually win against Trump. But
here's the clue. The minute you think that, you make it true.
It is true.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it. And, you know, I am the one who can win. Why? Because I'm the one who can win.
Yeah.
Well, all right. As we said, again, to recap what we said last time, we're doing what the economist John Maynard Keynes called a beauty pageant.
Yes.
So British beauty pageants weren't like, you know, a bunch of people parade in bikinis and you pick the prettiest one. You were given 100 faces in the picture in a newspaper and you were asked to pick what you thought everyone else would think was the prettiest one.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of second order guessing that we're doing. The Democrats always do this, right?
Yeah.
Why was John Kerry the candidate? Because John Kerry was the type of person that could beat Bush.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't. Why? Yeah. Because it wasn't about him. You just projected onto him this thing that he was the one who could beat Bush. And it's the same thing. Why do you beat a 70-year-old white guy who's really angry?
Yeah.
A 70-year-old white guy who's not angry, right? That seems
not
to be the entire logic. There's nothing else there.
But the Democrats will say exactly that. He can beat him, slash, and then nitpick him to death or nitpick the candidate to death. Right. So it's never even a full-fledged support.
It's always secondhand support. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the Republicans don't do that. I mean, Republicans are...
They hated this guy and they are going to get lockstep behind him and they will just go for it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Meanwhile, be like, hey, do you like our empty suit? We personally don't like him, but we hope some Republicans do.
Yeah.
And do you think Elizabeth Warren and particularly Bernie's troops are going to get out and bang the doors and mobilize for the empty suit?
No.
Don't think so.
In fact, I think they will stay home on purpose.
Right. And therefore, this pleases the centrist Democrats, particularly the multimillionaire, multibillionaire donor class, because their version of politics is, great, we've got our empty suit, we'll just spend lots of money and whoever spends the most money wins.
Yeah.
That, the one thing Trump showed us, that's not true.
Yes.
And they're still playing by those rules.
Completely. And the Democrats just haven't gotten... Democrats can't organize themselves to actually move beyond that particular...
Because then they'd actually have to have an honest fight about who they are and who they want to be when they grow up.
And you're just like, can you not have that therapy session on a national stage? Like someone
have to, and then you get over it. Other political parties do this.
But I think there needs to be a stronger leader. This is where authoritarianism, I think, is more efficient than democracy, because you just need to have the smoke-filled back rooms where someone decides, you're going to run for president and that's it, and everyone falls in line behind this person.
Yeah, or alternatively, you have, not that I'm a huge fan of much of what he did, including Iraq and cozying up to bankers, but this is the genius of Tony Blair. He basically took a party that no one believed in and just said, look, the only reason this is down is because you can't articulate clearly who you want to be when you grow up.
Yeah.
And he articulated a set of beliefs and values that were very much apropos that moment.
Yeah.
And he won three elections.
No, I think that's exactly right. The Democrats, I don't think the Democrats could say three bullet points of what the party is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas the Republicans got
exactly right.
More money for me, you.
Yes, yes. And on this note, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think, had her maybe like seventh cycle of cancer. And I just think there's going to be an open seat on the court, I think, pretty soon.
Of course.
That's the pessimist inside of me. Of course, I hope it stays stable. But I mean, you just feel like that's happening too. And then the Republicans are really good.
See, again, I come back to this with the foreigner's eyes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that American liberals fixate on the Warren Court as if it was the norm. It wasn't. It was the exception.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always been a conservative institution. And despite that fact, you had everything from the New Deal right the way through to today.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah.
You got civil rights with a conservative court initially.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, it's not just you have to have control of that.
Well, and to your point, I mean, research as much as it can, because it's such a small end, you see that the court justices as individuals moderate over time as well. I mean, on both sides, left and right. And
because they talk to each other and they have this thing called the law.
Yes.
You know, so the case that's coming up on whether trans people can be denied employment, right? There's the three cases that are coming up. And the law on this, there was an NPR piece about this. I'm riffing off of this, right? I'm not a constitutional law expert, right? But basically the gist of it was the following. Regardless of what you think about this normatively, it either falls under, I think it's Section 7 of some act, or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, then you can make that case, but you got to make that case. Now, that's the act of interpretation, and maybe being a conservative or not has some play in that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not like you pack this and you get whatever you want on your side of the spectrum.
Yep.
It kind of has to fit within the framework of law.
Yeah.
And I think we forget about that as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. On a slightly different note, and something that as we start to wrap up, I watched the speech given, and I'm going to forget his name, of the Sikh member of the House of Commons who stood up and really more than chastised the prime minister about one of the articles that he wrote that used a lot of harsh language toward Muslim women. And I have to say, in that moment, I thought, wow, like this is what we have to have this in the United States as well. And to hold somebody accountable like that, for Johnson to have to sit there and face this particular member, I thought was really powerful, and something that I wish that we could somehow replicate in the U.S. Just that personal accountability of having to have someone say, how could you do this? What did you learn this summer? Or what was a highlight of your summer?
Well, actually, let's start with the first one. I learned two things.
Okay.
I learned drums.
Oh, exciting.
Right. Not that I'm like now Neil Peart from Russia or anything like that, but like, you know, I started to relearn drums. When I was 15, I learned drums and I switched to bass. And then I realized why I suck and why most young people are depressed.
Wait, drums are not just banging out. There's actual technique.
Oh yeah, there's tons of technique. But I'll show you paradiddles later. But anyway, and they all sound funny, but that's a different story. Anyway, here's what happened. So I start working with a drum teacher.
Yes.
And I'm playing and it's good and it's great. And I thought, well, I'll go on YouTube. And then I discovered this thing, and I encourage everyone to do this, just if you want to put a smile on your face, yeah. because there's still amazing things in this world.
Yes.
Go put into YouTube, Denmark's Got Talent winner 2017.
Okay.
And it's this 10-year-old girl yeah. who's the best drummer you've ever seen in your life, doing the full John Bonham playing to Led
Whoa.
Zeppelin. And it's that moment you go, that's wonderful. But then you immediately go, holy crap, I'll never be as good as that 10-year-old, right?
Yeah, right.
Now, I used to be a bass player, and I thought I was at one point quite good, but that was long before we had YouTube. So yeah. I was comparing myself to like much smaller groups of people. Now I can compare myself to like bass players all across the yeah. globe. I might as well be hitting a xylophone with a cement mixer in comparison to what these people do.
Yeah.
So imagine now if I was, you know, a kid, a 15-year-old, 13-year-old yeah. kid, and I'm picking up the guitar for the first yeah. time. I'm like, oh, I wonder what's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you put it on, just put the guitar away.
Yeah.
Because there's so much unbelievable talent out there.
Yeah.
It would just make me crushed. I would just go, I'm never going to be as good as that. Just put the whole thing away.
Because you used to hope to just be, oh, he's the best in the school or best in
right,
her grade.
Exactly.
And that was like really awesome.
And that
to be
was
the
awesome,
best in your
right?
grade.
Yeah. And now there's like people who can basically do, you know, the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy slap
yes.
bass. And you're
yes.
like, oh my God.
But we didn't know. We lived in like such a wonderful, like, you didn't know that there were all these really much more talented people out there in the world.
But this, I think there's a serious issue here, and it goes to sort of, you know, perfect Instagram lives and all the rest
yeah.
of it, right?
Yes.
That we're comparing ourselves to more and more people. More and more people's experiences are available for us to reflect ourselves against.
Yeah.
So we're just, you never get to switch off. One of
That's
the beauties
right.
of playing music in bands when I was a kid was it was four or five people in a garage or in a studio just making music
yeah.
with the door shut. There was
yeah.
no other world.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can do that now.
No, because you would think, oh, I want to post this. And then they'd go up and you'd see all the other bands
exactly.
around the world. Yeah. Yeah.
So what did you learn?
What did I learn? I don't know if I learned any, very much. I'm sure
did,
but the highlight of my summer, I have to say, is we stopped in some rural part of some rural German town, but they had these pools. There must have been some hot spring somewhere at some point. And so it was very odd because, you know, the only Americans and a lot of German retirees in these hot springs. But it was just really
Were they all naked?
No, they were not.
And that's odd in the East because they really went in for that stuff.
And it was just really beautiful. It was outside and there's this wonderful sunset. And to your point about that there are good things left in this world and nothing to do with the politics, it was just a nice, like, you know, the sun setting, there's like a little steam coming off the water. It was really nice. And you just think, maybe the world isn't as terrible.
And at that point you thought, maybe the EFD aren't so bad.
Yeah, they're okay. They give us good pools.
They give
yeah.
us good pools,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.